Well, again, tonight it's a joy to welcome you, greet you in Jesus' name, invite you to the service. And happy for all those that are here. Some of you have been here faithfully most of the nights. Maybe for somebody it's your first time you're here, you're certainly welcome to be here. It's a joy that we can share this time together. King David was king of Israel for 40 years. And when he died, he gave to his son Solomon a reign that was a kingdom that was 10 times larger than what he received from Saul, the predecessor of the king that was there before he was. And I doubt if the premier of your country here, president, is going to give to his the one who follows him, a kingdom that's 10 times larger. Canada is already one of the bigger countries in the world. And I don't think that Joe Biden will give to his follower a kingdom 10 times bigger than what he inherited from Mr. Trump. But that happened with David, and that's a tremendous truth, and a lot goes behind that. But you understand a couple things when I say that. You know that David never lost a battle. And it was not an easy thing to think about having to go to war with King David. You lost if you did that. Everybody did. He won every time. Now, God had plans for David from his youth. And before this boy was even anointed the first time, he was anointed twice. Just a young man tending his father's sheep, the Father of Heaven, the God of Heaven, called him a man after God's own heart and said that when David was quite young. Before he had that contest with Goliath, before he was anointed, God knew what he could expect from David. So let's stop right there. Now, what's the next thought? What's the next question? You got that figured out, don't you? Does God know what he could expect from us? Does God know? God knew what he could expect from David. Does God know what he can expect from us? So now here we are at the end of David's life. 40 years as king, 7 years over Judah, 33 years over the entire kingdom. David calls a solemn assembly. He calls that assembly in 1 Chronicles chapter 28. He addresses them, especially in chapter 29. I'm going to read verses 1 through 5 of that chapter. You can turn, if you wish to, in your Bibles to 1 Chronicles. We'll read here. Chapter 29, verses 1 through 5. Furthermore, David the king said unto all the congregation, Solomon, my son, whom alone God hath chosen, is yet young and tender. He was about 18 years old when he became king, so you know he was just a young man. And the work is great, for the palace is not for man, but for the Lord God. And David is speaking here about the temple that he expects his son Solomon to build for God. Now I have prepared with all my might for the house of my God, the gold for things to be made of gold, and the silver for things of silver, and the brass for things of brass, the iron for the things of iron, and wood for the things of wood. Onyx stones and stones to be set, glistering stones and of divers colors, and all manner of precious stones and marble stones in abundance. Moreover, because I have set my affection to the house of my God, I have of mine own good of gold and silver, which I have given to the house of my God over and above all that I have prepared for the holy house. even 3,000 talents of gold, of the gold of Ophir, and 7,000 talents of refined silver to overlay the walls of the house withal. The gold for the things of gold, and the silver for the things of silver, and for all manner of work to be made by the hands of the artificers. And who then is willing to consecrate his service this day unto the Lord? That last question is the important thing here. Who then is willing to consecrate his service this day unto the Lord? David was not asking anybody else to do what he had not himself done. This is one of the marks of a true leader of people. It's one of the marks of a true servant. It's one of the marks that he would not ask of somebody else to do something he would not be willing to do himself. In fact, he would probably take the more difficult task. That's how Stonewall Jackson lost his life. He was a general during the Civil War down in the country south of you. He needed to send some sentries over to examine enemy territory, see their camps, see how things were going there, see how things were, see what kind of preparations they had there and what their munitions looked like, and he decided to do that job himself. He made one mistake. He didn't tell his own sentries that he was doing it. And when he came back into his camp, his people thought that it was an enemy that was coming in there, and they tried to defend their quarters there and shot their own general. But he was willing to do the hardest thing himself. And David did not ask anything of anybody else that he himself was not willing to do. So he was an example to these people. He was an example to the flock. How did David become what he turned out to be? And we read those words, I think that was last night. Or when was that? Was that tonight? Search me, O God, that was tonight, wasn't it? And David wrote those words. How did David get to become the person he turned out to be? He was the sweet psalmist of Israel, it tells us. But he was more than that. He was a worshiper of the high God. He's one of the few people in the Bible who is called a man of God. That term is used for very few people in the Bible. It's used of David. I was preaching in a church in Virginia. It was the last night. A young man came to the front to close the meeting. I didn't know him very well. His wife was battling cancer in her life at that particular time. She was just a young lady. He came front and had a very quiet voice and asked the congregation to open the song book that you sang from tonight and asked them to turn to a certain number and led that song. And I was sitting close to the back by that time, and I was paying close attention to this, the way he was doing that. And when he was finished, his wife was sitting quite near to where I was, so I walked over to her and I said, "Your husband is a worshiper of the high God." And she said, "Yes, Brother Dale, that's true." How did I know that? A worshiper. The Father seeketh such. They that worship in spirit and truth, the Father seeketh such to worship him. I like us to think about that. It's nothing that is forced. It's nothing that's required. It's not something that's done by law. It's not done by obligation. It's just voluntary. Not only that, it's done in secret. Where no praiseful trumpet bloweth, where he may not reap who soweth, in the work which no man knoweth, with the door shut, and the Father seeth in secret, it rewards you openly. This is where volunteers are born. The The only thing we do that is truly voluntary is what we do when no one else knows about it. As soon as what we do becomes public knowledge, there can soon be another motive for what we're doing and not true, wholehearted, voluntary worship. It could be something else. If you hear me when I sing, I'm immediately living with a temptation to try to be somehow or another impressionable about that. But what we do in secret, no one else knows about it. That is something different. This is not to challenge anybody. It's not to startle you. I don't ask this question tonight to condemn anybody, but I'm going to ask a question. I can only ask this question to six people here, because the rest of you I know nothing about. I'm going to ask this question to six people, to six men that I met this evening in a prayer room downstairs. And these men gave names that they felt we should pray for. I did not know the people they were talking about. It was hard for me to follow. I don't know who these people are. I think they all knew everybody that was named, but I didn't know any of them. So now this is a question for those six men. Do you pray for the same people in private when no one else hears you? That's the first question. The second question is more serious. Did you ever shed any tears for those names that you prayed for tonight? You see, it's what we do in secret. It's who we are in secret that makes the decisive difference as to who we are. We can do about anything in public, but what are we doing in private? And of course, for that to happen, we can't pray in a hurry. For that to happen, it takes some time. Let my heart be broken by that which breaks the heart of God. It takes time to know the heart of God. And when God says that David's a man after God's own heart, he's saying there that David knew the heart of God. Or he could not have been a man after God's own heart. And God knew that he understood his heart. David felt what God felt. Probably not perfectly, you know that. But I'm looking at verse 5 here tonight. And who then is willing to consecrate his services this day unto the Lord? And so we're titling these thoughts this evening, the Cost of Voluntary Consecration. And I don't like to emphasize too hard that word cost, because the cost is not quite what you think. In one sense, it would seem like, depends on how we present these thoughts tonight, that the cost is extremely high, and very few are ever going to pay that price, and very few are ever going to be willing to do this, and it's going to be a very small number that ever is going to attain unto this voluntarism, to this voluntary consecration. It's going to be very, very few people. But there's another way to look at that word cost. And that is the cost of not doing it, of not being a voluntary worshiper, of not consecrating ourselves voluntarily to God. So what is consecration? What are we talking about? And as I understand it, consecration is one of the highest acts of worship. In the strictest sense, maybe it's the highest act of worship. You see, nobody can do any more than this, than to offer himself willingly to God. There's nothing more that anybody can do for the Lord. There's nothing more that anyone can give to God. There's nothing more costly of an offering that anyone can ever bring to God than to bring himself, herself, wholly to God. That is the greatest sacrifice that anybody can make. That is the voluntary consecration that we're talking about here. Abraham Lincoln said, we cannot consecrate, we cannot dedicate, we cannot hallow this ground. Hallow this ground. That was in his Gettysburg Address. He was thinking about that battlefield there where far, far, far too many people lost their lives. Normally speaking, we speak about dedicating things. We can dedicate a place or a person or an object. We can dedicate something, but consecration is something we do for ourselves. We consecrate ourselves to God. Our own lives, our own body, our own being. It's what the Bible means when it says, with all your heart. We have that back in the Shema back there. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. That's what it means. It's a complete consecration. That means there's nothing reserved. That means nothing was left for myself. That means my hand is off the controls. That means that I'm not holding the reins. That means that I'm not making the decisions. That means that I'm only doing one thing. I'm choosing what God has chosen. I get to know God to the place where I know what he chooses for my life, and then I choose what he has chosen. And so it's God's decision, it's not mine. When we consecrate this to God, that's what happens. Up until that time, I had the choice in the matter. There comes a time when I don't have a choice in the matter. So it's the highest form of worship that I would understand that we could possibly experience. So it's the practical application to that Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one Lord, and thou shalt love with all thy heart. So it's a practical expression of love. It's the measure to which we love God, determined by how much we're willing to turn over to him, how much of myself I give to him, what of my life belongs to him, what I want him to be controlling completely, and for me to have nothing to do with it except yield to that which God has chosen. That's true love. That's a practical application of love, a practical expression of love with all thy heart. Look at verse 17 of this same chapter here. This might help us get a little idea of what's going on. I know also, my God, that thou triest the heart, and hast pleasure in uprightness. As for me, in the uprightness of my heart, I have willingly offered all these things, and now have I seen with joy thy people, which are present here, to willingly offer unto thee uprightness. Rightness of heart, righteousness of heart, right wiseness, a right manner. It's a heart that has only one motive, the righteousness of God. That God be glorified, that God be great, that God be known, that God be worshipped, that God be honored. I'm serving, I'm making this offering, I'm making this willing sacrifice, I'm voluntarily consecrating this to you and myself to you because that's the condition of my heart. My heart says I should do this. Look at verse 18. O Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, our fathers, keep this forever in the imagination of the thoughts of the heart of thy people, to prepare their heart unto thee. What's it say here? A prepared heart. A heart that knew what it was doing, understood why it made the choices that it did. And here they're bringing things. They're bringing gold and silver and these stones and these things you talked about in wood and brass. They're bringing these things. That's what they're doing here. But that's not what you and I are doing. We're bringing something else. And it's not too hard to get people to bring things. But it's something else for me to bring myself. Here I am, God. Here I am. Look at verse 19. And give unto Solomon my son a perfect heart to keep thy commandments, thy testimonies, and thy statutes, and to do all these things, and to build the palace for which I have made provision. A perfect heart. No reservations. No hidden agenda. Nothing reserved for myself. I'm going to read to you a New Testament parallel to this passage. This is in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. It's a New Testament example, maybe, of what we're reading about here. Moreover, brother, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the church of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying us with much entreaty that we would receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. And this they did, not as we hoped, but first gave their own selves to the Lord and unto us by the will of God. And they had an upright heart, and they had a prepared heart, and they had a perfect heart, and they gave themselves first. And then it was not very difficult to give the things that were needed along with that after they had given themselves to God. This is the first thing they did. And this they did not as we hope, but first gave their own selves to the Lord. This is what voluntary consecration is. That's the difference between Old Testament worship and New Testament worship. In the Old Testament, you brought things, cattle, lambs, goats, turtle doves. You brought offerings to God. You brought about 30% of your income was given to the Lord. If you were an Old Testament saint, if you were a Jew in the Old Testament, you gave about 30% of your income to offerings to the Lord, approximately that. But in the New Testament, it's different. Not animals, not tithes, not fruits of the land, not fat of rams, not 10,000 of rivers of oil, but just one thing. Myself. Just myself. It's what we sometimes call discipleship. It's a very beautiful word. Discipleship. It's what Jesus did. He gave himself. In the volume of the book that is written of me to do thy will, O God. Not my will, but thine be done. I choose for myself tonight in this Garden of Gethsemane what you have chosen for me. So he looks at his disciples and he says to them, follow me. And I think of that German word that our Anabaptist forefathers would have used in their German language, Gelassenheit, which means self-abandonment, an emptying of myself. That's a difficult thing to do. It wouldn't take me long to empty this. I wouldn't want to make a mess here on this carpet, but I could just take this and pour it front, and it would soon be empty. It wouldn't take long to empty that, and then there'd be nothing in it, nothing left for this glass, nothing left inside this. It's empty. But for me to take myself and pour myself out like that, that's a job. Just to dump that over and pour that all out. Stephen did that. Jesus did that. Joseph did that. Daniel did that. Many people have done that. Everything was poured out, and nothing was left for themselves. Self-abandonment. Self-emptying. This is what this is. In Philippians chapter 2 there, in verse 7, our Spanish Bible says that he did not get a hold of this, but he said, despojó de sí mismo. He emptied himself out, so there was nothing left. He emptied it all out of there. It's an amazing concept. Just no Dale left in here. That would be beautiful if that could happen. Selfishness gone. Self-seeking gone. The desire for some kind of eminence or praise or recognition, some kind of reward, gone. Trying to help someone this week with a very serious marriage problem, and this is not my subject tonight, but I'm just going to mention it here because it certainly applies to this whole matter of pouring out yourself. This man is a very successful man. He is very intelligent. He is a gifted person. Anything he does in a superlative way. He's talented way above many other people. And this dear man married a wife. If you would be that man's wife, you would be probably in a very difficult place because no one can match him. His poor little wife does not have the ability he has. His poor little wife does not execute things to immaculate perfection like he does. His poor little wife cannot measure up to his lofty standards. His poor little wife is continually ridiculed for her failings and her mistakes and her weaknesses. His poor little wife, he tells her, does not give to him the honor that's due to him. If you have a husband like that, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with him. I hope you don't have one like that, but if you do, I'm going to tell you what's wrong with him. A man like that, because of his ability, because of his prowess, because of his capacity, he lives every day in a continual awards assembly where he's receiving awards all the time. He's receiving applause and praise and recognition and all the time. And his heart craves that. He's got to have that because he's performing. He's doing this thing so well. This thing must come my way. So he lives in a continual awards assembly, if you ever win one of those. And his little wife doesn't know how to do that. She just cannot muster up the acclaim that he feels is owed to him. That marriage would be healed overnight. You understand? If we could pour that out and get rid of that out of his life. That marriage would be healed immediately. It just wouldn't take long to fix that at all. So this poor wife, and there might be someone here like that tonight, this poor little wife goes through life blaming herself. She figures that she's not qualified. She's not able. Her husband was worth more than she can give him. He should have had a far better wife than what he got. She's a very poor representation of what he should have been able to marry, but he ended up with her, so she feels guilty for it. So that's what we're trying to work on. That's what we're trying to fix. That husband of hers does not understand what voluntary consecration is. He doesn't understand that. Reminds me of the parable of the ox. Voluntary consecration is like the parable of the ox. Here's a picture of an ox. Under the ox, it says these words, to the altar or to the plow. And the ox does not make that decision. Someone else does. You're going to the altar today. You're going to be sacrificed there. This will be the end of you. Or we'll put you to a plow and you're going to be doing that. And no matter if it's this or if it's that, the ox gets no benefit out of it either way, either here nor there. I'm doing this for somebody else. That's what my life is for. Would someone please, if there's anyone that can get any benefit out of it, that's what this is all about. That's why Christ came to this earth. That's the parable of the oxen. To the altar, to the plow, ready to go, ready to stay. I'll go where you want me to go, dear Lord. I'll be what you want me to be. Where we give up all of our own prerogative and surrender our own will and choose for ourselves what God has already chosen. That's voluntary consecration. You know Romans 12:1. There's an interesting phrase in Romans 12:1 that maybe gets overlooked sometimes. It tells us there that I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And of course, you know that if it was not holy, it would not be acceptable to God. He does not accept part of an offering. He doesn't accept a partial sacrifice. He doesn't accept it if we keep back part of the price. He doesn't accept a partial commitment. But it says there, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God. It's not the tyranny of God. It's not the austere lordship of God. It's not the haughtiness or greatness or that of God. It's not the demand of God. It's not the vengeance of God. It's the mercy of God. Dale, I want you to give me everything that you have because I'm a merciful father. And what does that mean? It means if I would be willing to do that, I'll experience that mercy. I will find out that all my life is in better condition under his control than it was under mine. I will find out that life is much better lived with him in charge of it than when I was. I will find out that that's the most gracious place to take it, the most beautiful place to deposit what that little bit that was in there. The best place to pour that out that ever could have been poured out was right there into the Father's hand. I beseech you, Dale, by the mercy of God, give me your life. I'll take care of it for you. Let me have it. So you didn't understand what I meant by that, so I'll give you an illustration so you understand it. We talked about about this shepherd boy David. We talked about that Goliath. I said that God said he was a man after his own heart before Goliath. So just like you think about this great big man with this tremendous stature, and he defied Israel 80 times during those 40 days, and the God of heaven, he defied that. And he has this armor here, and he's got an armor bearer in front of him carrying a shield in front of him, and he's got all this koto on him, all this maya, all this, you call it what? There's his armor that he was wearing. All this weight on him. Hard to walk, you would think so, with as much as what that Bible says it added up to by weight. Here's this fellow coming at him with a slingshot. I don't know if he even saw the slingshot. He said, you're bringing some kind of a stave here. What do you got here? Some kind of a walking stick? What's the matter? You're crippled? You need a stick to walk? What are you coming to me for like that? So he mocked him. But can you imagine the difference? What would the difference have been in that story if Goliath would have come walking up to David and said, son, just a minute. Reached into this sheath and pulled out a sword and said, David, take this. It'd be better off in your hands than it is in mine. Is there anything else I could give you, David? Could I just walk in behind you and get on your side? Could I just be on your team? What else could I give you, David? I'm glad to do that. It would have been the mercy of David. It would have been the sure mercies of David if he'd have done that. But we haven't learned to think that way. We have to reserve it. We have to be in control of it. We have to have the last word in it. We can't let God have it. So it's the altar life. Ever being offered, yet ever still alive. Ever being offered, yet still more there to offer. Ever being given, still yet more to give. All belong to God, yet new opportunities come up and more opportunities come our way, and that goes to God too, and that also is turned over to the Lord in your life. Because his mercy endureth forever. It's a position of faith. It believes God. And we know enough about God to know this, that if it's for his own glory, then it will be for our own good. It's just the way it works. Anything that brings glory to God is for our good. That's why it says, for the sure mercies of David. That's why it says, I beseech you therefore by the mercies of God. We know that he is no fool who gives that which he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose. Consecration is life as Jesus showed us how to live it. But now let's go a little further. What is voluntary consecration? The cost of voluntary consecration, what is it? The text we read there, 1 Corinthians 29:5, asked for those who were listening to David to willingly consecrate. Do it willingly. This was not a tax. It was not a church standard. It was not a conscription. No one is being drafted here. This is not an army. This is a Green Beret. if you know the difference there. Only volunteers in the Green Beret. Tennesseans, volunteer state. That's what it's called. Look at verse 6 of this chapter. Volunteers. Then the chief of the fathers and princes of the tribes of Israel, the captains of thousands of hundreds, with the rulers of the king's work, offered willingly. Look at verse 14. But who am I and what is my people that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort? For all things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee. We just returned it back. You gave it to us in the first place. Look at verse 17. I know also, my God, that thou triest the hearts as pleasure in uprightness. As for me, in the uprightness of mine heart, I have willingly offered all these things. And now I have seen with joy thy people, which are present here, to offer willingly unto thee. But there's a sad note here. In verses 18 and 19, he's talking about Solomon. And he mentioned that this young man has a perfect heart, but something happened to it. You see, at 18 years of age, he had a perfect heart. At 18 years of age, his father gave him the pattern of this temple that should be built. At 18 years of age, he knew the king of Hiram up there in Tyre that he was going to depend upon to help bring some materials down to build this thing. At 18 years of age, he had the desire to build this thing just like his daddy had suggested. But something happened to Solomon. And when Solomon achieved and accumulated and gathered and grew and became famous, and the queen of Sheba came, and all these things happened to Solomon, and he got married about who knows how many hundred times. And he had all these wives and all these riches and all these horses and all these stables, and he had all these chariots, he had all this stuff that he got from the Hittites. And as his things grew and grew and grew, this thing was filling up and filling up and filling up. It wasn't being poured out. And his wife turned his heart away from the Lord. And he died a very cynical man. And Brother Dennis told us tonight that cynicism is one thing we should get out of our hearts if she'd be getting out of here. I heard him say that. So one time it was voluntary, but one day it wasn't. And maybe it was voluntary when we didn't have very much to give. We didn't realize the cost of it. Didn't realize what was going to come up in life. Didn't realize what kind of offerings we might someday be asked to make. And as time went on, this thing became more and more my own. And I held it with a closed fist and held it tight. And Solomon did that. There's no willing consecration there. Solomon began very willingly, but something happened to that perfect heart for which David here was praying. Christ has only volunteer disciples. The cost is great, but no one is forced into it. If any man will come after me, if any man wishes to, if any man chooses to, if any man makes that choice, this is what he wants to do. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And many turned back from following him, followed him no more, even as Solomon turned back. And many people follow Jesus to the breaking of bread, but they will not follow to the drinking of the cup of his passion. They don't go that far. They quit before they get there. John the Baptist was made a voluntary consecration. He didn't live very long. He served in his public ministry for about 1 year. That's all the longer it lasted. But he got a tremendous amount done in that year. It's not a matter of who your ancestors are. You're not in this thing because others did it and you were born into it. That's not how it comes. Not as the sons of the crescent with their conquering swords. Not like the Inquisition, which turned many non-Catholics into nominal Roman Catholics because the force was there and they had to do it. They went down to Cusco and took those Inca Indians and burned enough of them alive and put enough of the others' feet in the fire and shriveled up their feet, burned them all up, so that they got the whole nation to just capitulate and accept the religion. Christ doesn't come that way to us. God doesn't do that to us. That's not voluntary when that happens. That's not a voluntary commitment. That's not a voluntary consecration. You're forced to do that. You see, it's not by the will of man. It's by voluntary choice. And Christ invites us to come and calls us by name and longs for our response and patiently stands and waits while the charming and bewitching world is also beckoning and saying, come my way. You'll find in the book of Proverbs, you'll find two women in the book of Proverbs. Some of you are young people here tonight, but you'll find two women in the book of Proverbs. Young men sitting in this assembly are hearing this voice. There are two women in Proverbs. And one is a woman of the street. And she leaves her house because out the street she finds a young man out there. And she beckons him and bewitches him and allures him and tempts him and lies to him and offers him things that she cannot supply. And this unwise young person finds himself following her back to her house. That woman is in the book of Proverbs, and she represents this world with its bewitching and wicked perversions. There's another woman in Proverbs, and she stands at a house with seven pillars, and she calls and puts forth her voice. She says, come, young men, and hear wisdom, and hear instruction, and be true, and be holy, and be right. And this woman is calling, and this is the voice of the word of God, the word of truth, calling you. And we answer one of those two voices, and we do it voluntarily. Christ or Caesar, and we choose. And we do it this way, we choose. And we give it to Christ. You think of Perpetua there and her slave girl, Felicia, and they're in that large arena. And the crowd is cheering. This is going to be exciting. These are two women. They're going to be slaughtered. We're going to watch this happen. It's one thing to see a man get butchered. These are two precious women. Perpetua was a noble lady, but she loved the young girl that worked with her in her house. And both were Christians, and both were out there together. You see, before this crowd with its roaring, before these bulls were left loose, before this whole assembly had their blood curdling with the scene that was before them, Perpetua stepped out into the middle of the arena and looked up at the people. He just turned around and looked at all the people like that. And then she went like this with her finger. She pointed to all these people in the grandstands. And then she pointed to herself. People are watching her. What is she trying to say? And then she stood there in the majesty of a moment before this whole thing broke loose, and she pointed her finger straight up. And then she pointed to the people. And what she said was this: you are all watching us, and you're going to do this to us. But he is watching you, and he will do it to you. It was a voluntary decision, and she did not get out of that arena alive, nor did her companion. He that saves his life shall lose it, but he that loses his life for my sake shall save it. Voluntarily give it up, voluntarily sell it, voluntarily pour it out, voluntarily turn it over, like Goliath, his sword to David. What is the cost of voluntary discipleship? What is the cost of voluntary consecration? We could ask, what does it cost to not consecrate ourselves to God? Why have martyrs up until today been voluntarily willing to give all that they've had to God? Why have they done that? If the cost is so high, why are souls still pressing into the kingdom of God? We still have converts coming to our churches in Costa Rica. Why are people doing that? I don't know how much you're seeing that happen here in Brooks, Alberta. But around the world, people are still seeking Christ. Around the world, people that know it's going to cost greatly are willing to pay that cost. Why are they doing that? If the cost is so high, why are souls still pressing into the kingdom of Christ? It is because it costs more to not do it. Absolute surrender, no reserves, no return, no reward in this life. Where God alone has the last word, regardless of what becomes of us, that doesn't matter. As long as God is in charge, that's all I care. This is the way we think when we make a voluntary consecration. Where I relinquish all of my own will and preference and planning. You see, one of the problems we have as young people is that we know that sometime we're going to make a choice. We're going to make a decision. We don't know what it's going to be, but we're going to make a decision to join the congregation. We're going to do that. We're going to do what's necessary to fit in. We're going to follow along, and we're going to do that someday. We don't know when, but we plan to do that. But we have a problem. Along with that, we know what our goals are. We know what our plans are for ourselves. We know the pickup truck we're going to buy. We know the courtship we're going to have. We know the business venture that's waiting for us. We know the property we're going to get a hold of. What kind of cell phone we're going to have. We know what that hunting cabin is that we're going to own. And that compound Bella and Dad Cabela's, we know what they've got to for sale in there that's going to soon be on my shelf and in my closet. We know about that investment opportunity that's coming up. And whatever all it is. We reserve those things for ourselves, and we know, yep, I'll do the church thing, but it's going to be under these conditions. It doesn't work. I mean, it might fool somebody for a while, but it will not be very effective very long. It's not a man after God's own heart. And God can look at you, young man, young lady, and say, I choose you because I know what I can do with your life. I know the mileage, I know the commitment, I know the value, I know the commitment I'm going to get from you. I choose you, I need you. You're one of mine. He won't say that about a person that comes to him that way. With all those reservations and with all that selfish thinking and with all that prideful thought about himself, this is who I am and this is what I'm going to be. We don't make those decisions. God makes those decisions. So we have all those ideas, we have this pickup truck, we have all this stuff. But dear people, it could be that we will experience none of that, but it doesn't matter. I assure you, it does not matter if we experience none of that. But worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive honor and glory and wisdom and power and might. God does not owe me any of it. And there's peace and joy in the heart if we're deprived of all of it. So that's the practical cost. The blessing is in this, dear brothers and sisters, in being able to graciously receive it if God chooses it for our lives and gladly forgoing the things others enjoy if it's not God's will for me. That's perfectly all right. That's voluntary consecration. Have you ever made a commitment like that to the Lord? Have you made a consecration like that to God?
Does God know that he may do that in your life? Does God know he has that kind of access? Does God know that he has the freedom to do anything with your life that he wants to do? Does God know that? When did you tell him that? When did you make that decision?
There may come in your life a crisis moment. This happened to me in my experience. I don't want it to happen to you, but it happened to me that you might not be able to make this commitment. You might not make this consecration until you come to a serious crisis in your life. David did not need a serious crisis in his life. He made this decision when he was quite innocent. He made this decision in a very natural way. There was not pressure on him. There was not a crisis that he could no longer handle. And so he said, I guess it's about time for me to yield here. I fought long enough. I've resisted long enough. I guess I can't fight anymore. I guess I better. That's the way I did, but that's not what David did. It could happen to you tonight. But we have to make that total consecration sometimes. It happens to God's children in distinct ways. But there must come sometime this willing consecration of ourselves, our lives, our service, everything we have to God. That day must come. I don't know how much I should say about this. I was visiting with a young pastor from another church group. It's not an Anabaptist type of church group, not a Mennonite type background, not an Amish. A very conservative group of people, but not Anabaptist. This young man was a minister in that church, and he just felt that the church that he was a part of and had given his life to and was raised in as a child, as a young man, and was married to. He had a wife and had some small children. He saw that this church was going more and more and more a wrong direction. He did not know what to do. It was drifting, accommodated to the culture and going a wrong direction. They knew that sooner or later he couldn't do that. And he was a preacher in this church, and he tried to give some warnings about that. And the elders of the church, the supervisors and the people in charge there, they came to him and tried to calm him down. And you fit in, and you go along with the program here, and you don't bother our dear people with your conscience and your concerns. You live up to the times, and your message should adjust itself to the conditions in which we're living. And this poor preacher did not know what to do. And so he had an interview with me, told me what he's going through, and later I found out that he said these words. He said, I just came to the place where I did this right here. He said, I fell down on a heap. I just was a pile, just a glob of me right there on the ground. I told God, this is all I have left. And you take it from there, and whatever you choose to do with my life, that's fine. I'm finished. I'm not going to fight this system. I'm not going to resist this, but I want to yield to you. You take it from there. Shortly after that, he was silenced from the ministry of his church. And then he began a search for something different. And I had a chance to see what God did to his beautiful wife and to his lovely daughters. I saw the changes that came to that family after Daddy did that. And God asked that from every one of us. A dear mother of about 7 children, had a husband whose heart beat for a very lonely place of the world, an unreached place of the world, a 1040 window where the gospel has not been preached and where churches are not found there. Her husband wanted to take the family there and serve the Lord there. And there was an opportunity for that. And we would have supplied a mission opportunity for this family. We would have sponsored them. We would have helped oversee this work if they would have been able to go there. But the wife said no. The wife said, I can't do that. And so the husband told me about it. He said he's just going to pray. He's just going to wait on the Lord. He's going to just not nag his wife about it. He's not going to keep bringing it up. He's just going to pray and see what God does. He's going to put this in God's hands. He wants to take his family there, but right now she's not ready, and he will not do it until she is. And that woman got deathly sick. She was in bed for a long period of time. You could not get out of bed, could not serve her family, could not make a meal. It happened on a Wednesday night. There was a church service in their local community there, and the husband was going to take the family to church. And before he left, he stepped up beside the bed, and his wife said, "It's okay, honey, you can go. You go to church. I think I'll be okay until you get back. I'll just stay here in bed. I can't go anywhere. You just go and take the children." And he left with the children, and there she was in her bed, and she started praying to God. And God said, "Did you make a right decision? Are you sure this is what your answer is to me? What are you holding out for? What benefit is this to you to have your own will, to have your own way? Why don't you surrender to me?" And in the absence of her husband, there on that bed, that mother began to pray. And she said, "Lord, if this is your will for me to go to that place with my family, I'm ready to go. I will go wherever you send me to go." When her husband and children came home from the church service that night, mother was out in the kitchen and had the supper ready. She was healed and ready to go. And all was over. But this right here. There was a young couple who just got married. I needed them in a mission project. But I had to interview them to see if they were prepared, if they were had a faith stance, if they were sufficiently yielded to the Lord, if they had made that consecration. I had to check with that before I could send them to where we wanted them to go. And so I had this moment came and we were going to be together, and now I'm talking to this young couple, and I look at the young lady and the new bride, and I say to her, "Sister, you're a new wife, you're a new bride here, and you're going to want a nest, you're going to want a home, you're going to want a place that's your own, you're going to want a house to take care of, you're going to want a place to put your things and set up your wedding gifts, and you're going to want a place to entertain your guests, and you're going to want a place that you call home." And I said, "It's going to be extremely cold weather in some places where you're going to be, and extremely hot weather in some other places where you're going to be, and we can't promise you those niceties. There's going to be a lot of privations. What do you think about that?" She said, "God decides the weather, not me. God will decide where we shall be. That's not my decision. It will be all right if I have a house or if I don't." And I said to her, "You'll be on the road a lot of the time. There's a lot of territory you're going to have to cover. I can't promise you that you'll have a home of your own. What do you say about that?" And here's what she did. She took her hand and laid it on the shoulder of her husband, and she said these words, "No matter where he is, if I'm with him, I'll be at home.
it'll be okay. I said, go. I can't. I have no reason to not send you. Go. You're ready to go. Go. They're still there. Still doing it. Still doing the same thing. How many more stories like that should I tell you? I'm going to end this evening by saying this. You say to me, Brother Dale, I'm not sure if I've ever made a commitment that's deep, that sincere, that complete to God or not. I'm not sure. Well, I think maybe we could help you decide whether you did or not. May I say this to you? Complete consecration is a surrender of life to God. It's a broken and contrite heart. It's a yielded will where all resistance is gone. And no defense for myself and no expectation for my own benefit. If I am frustrated by life circumstances, if I am upset because it didn't turn out my way, if I find myself fighting against it when the day gave me some interruptions and reversals that I was not anticipating, when I let the others around me know that I can't stand to be treated this way and don't you know who I am and I deserve something better than what I got out of this, then don't worry about it. The consecration has never been made. If I can accept whatever comes in life and with a bowed heart and with a quiet spirit and with resignation, if I can't do that, it's because I have yet to learn how to live the life that Christ taught me to live. And I will say this, so none of you feel bad, so none of you feel like you are in a spotlight or in a vice right now. I would have thought, in my ignorance and foolishness, I would have thought that I was fairly well committed. I would have thought that I was a very unselfish person. I would have thought that I could accept about anything that comes along in life. I would have thought that I know how to take no for an answer and be satisfied with it. I've lived with robberies and all kinds of things. Yes, I can handle that. But I found out when my wife got ill that there was more selfishness in me than I realized. I found myself able, no problem, to get out of bed at 1 o'clock in the morning and take her to a restroom. And every trip to the bathroom requires lifting her up 5 times. Unfortunately, she doesn't weigh quite as much as I do. But then when half an hour later, you do that again. And I was so tired, at first didn't realize that she was squirming over there and trying to get my attention, that she needs help to get out of the bed. And I finally wake up and look at the clock and see that it was only half an hour ago we did the same thing. And then do that same thing 10 times in one night. And I soon found out that there was some resistance in here. I soon found out that I wasn't ready to do that. I soon found out that someone had transgressed into my space. Somebody didn't realize that I was supposed to be able to rest that night. And I learned that there's all kinds of areas in which you had things planned, but that didn't work out that way. And you couldn't go there because you had to stay here and take care of this. And you're not going anywhere today. And today you're not going to get that done, and you stay here and take care of this, and tomorrow you'll do the same thing, and 2 months later you're doing the same thing, and a half year later the same thing. So I decided I need to do something about this.
So my wife spends a good bit of time lying in bed, so I went in there and sat on the edge of the bed, and I held her hand, just looked at her, and she looked up at me, and I was looking down at her. I thought I'd talk to her a little bit. Suzanne, you're a very sweet wife. You're a beautiful person. Don't ever let me show any irritation. As if it's a struggle to take care of you, it's a great joy to do it. I want to serve you the best way I can. And let me know if there's anything else I can do for you. And the little girl in the bed starts to cry. And she reaches up her hand, but she has very weak hands, so she can't reach very well. And she tries to reach up and tries to touch. Even in a moment like that, that's as close to glory as you can get in this world. And it's possible for you to treat your wife like that. It's possible for you to treat your husband like that. It's possible for you to take care of your children like that. It's possible for you to face your employees like that. It's possible for you, no matter where you are in life, to be satisfied with the things that come up that you would not have chosen, but it's God's will for you now, and you can be a glory to his name and a testimony for those people wherever you are. That's voluntary consecration. If I can't do that with a broken heart, with no resistance to God, then I need to make another trip to the altar. Are we martyrs? Are we martyr material? I don't know what your eschatological persuasion is, but without an absolute surrender, we are nothing but hybrid material. A woman riding on the beast. Candidates for the registered church. Willing to accept a compromise with one world religion. Stephen would not do it. The pilgrim church pursues her way until the crown is won. And that's how she does it, on her knees with that consecration to God. And no reserves, and no regrets, and no reservations. And so I guess I'm just asking tonight to examine your hearts and see if there was ever done in this life, does God know that it's all his, it's all for him, and I'll take my hands off of it. If there's anything in it for me, that's one thing. But if he gets some glory from it, then that's what matters. And it's for him that we do it and not for us. And I realize you must eat something. I realize you need a rest sometimes. God knows that too. I realize you need some clothing. I realize you need a bed to sleep in, or at least some place to sleep. We don't need nearly as much for ourselves as we think we do. I know what it's like to be on these trips into the jungles, into Indian villages, where there are no hotels, there are no ATM machines, there are no A&W burger places, no Kentucky Fried Chicken. I know what it's like to be served a bowl of rice that's so dry it sticks to the roof of your mouth, and there's one wing of a chicken on there, and that chicken wing was not much bigger than the little finger you have on there on your hand. And so that was on top of the pile of rice, and it's so dry you can hardly get it down. But it's the only food there is to eat, and so you eat it, thank God for it. And then when it's time to go to bed, the floor is a board floor. You lie down on those boards and curl up and go to sleep. That's your bed. And it's perfectly all right. Next morning, you're already dressed and ready for the day. If you want to get a bath, there's a river out back. You go out there and do it out there.
I understand that Dan Sullivan's wife is in this room tonight, and she has an uncle named Ben. And one day, Brother Ben said to me, he said, "Dale, instead of going down that river, you stay up here, up here in these trees, and I'll get you a bucket and bring you some water. You get your bath up here." He was very kind to me. But it was okay to do the river too. But is that what I'm ready for? Is that what I have? Does God know that I'm okay with that? If there's food to eat, we eat it. If there's no food, we don't. If there's provisions and if there's accommodations, that's fine. If there isn't, we live with that. Does God know that in your life, that you're ready for that? This is the message tonight. I want you to think about it. Would you please think about it? And maybe you need to do something about it, but think about it. Listen, dear people, tonight I must close with this. There'd be far more Christians in our world if this message would not be true. There'd be far more Christians if you could do it your own way and be a child of God at the same time. There'd be far more Christians if it was up to me how I was going to carry this out. And no one can come to Christ that way. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up the cross and follow me. Let's stand for prayer. Thank you, Father, for teaching us in your patience tonight, your love for us, and because of your great mercies, you invite us to learn to know you in this way. Because you have a holy plan for our lives, because you have a purpose for us to fulfill that can be done in no other manner. Because you have nothing but good intentions for all of us and nothing but the best reserved for us, you ask us to give it all to you, O God. Father, it's a wise decision. It's a holy thing to do. We're thankful for that. We bless you for it. We only regret any resistance you find in us. We only regret any personal reservations that we hold back for ourselves. We only regret if we're still not quite ready to say to you, to give to you everything that's in here and pour it all out and find ourselves on a heap and all belongs to God. We rise from that heap with none of it now our own, and all of it belongs to you. If there's that still in us, then, Father, in your mercy and patience with us, bring us to that place where we bow down and worship you voluntarily with all of our heart and soul and strength, with all of what we are. And so help us to learn to do this, and help us to think this way, and help us to believe this way, and help us to live this way. And be patient with us when we make mistakes here, Father, when we get our eyes off of it, when we are mesmerized by the situation, when we are seeing the thing that's visible instead of the invisible, when we are noticing the outward and not seeing the internal, then forgive us, Father, and have mercy on us and give us another chance. Oh God, then give us another chance. So with this congregation tonight and with our thoughts and with our commitments, and dear God, send us home tonight with deep reflections and with a willingness to hear your voice speak to us, continue to instruct us and guide us into all truth. We pray that we'd have upright hearts and prepared hearts and perfect hearts so we could willingly give after this sort to a God who deserves all we are. And we ask this tonight in Jesus' name, amen. Been extremely attentive and reverent audience tonight. Extremely attentive, the children and the presence of everyone here. May God bless you for your reverence and your receptive hearts. May God bless your night. And we'd love to see you again tomorrow if the Lord would tarry. You have a good night.